So I'd like to start by thanking Bloomberg for the opportunity to be here again, speak to you about the Committed Liquidity Facility, or the CLF. There's going to be a lot of acronyms this morning, so apologies up front for that. The CLF has been in place now for almost 5 years, and as we announced in June, after a careful review, the Reserve Bank will be adjusting the settings of the CLF starting from next year. And today, I thought, in light of that, it'd be helpful to discuss the developments that have led us to make these adjustments. We've also published a detailed article on this on the RBA's website, so that's a bulletin article that should be available about now. But first, let's review why we need the CLF in the first place. Well, the global financial crisis highlighted just how important it is for banks to manage their liquidity risks. And during the crisis, many banks overseas faced significant liquidity problems, given that they had not paid enough attention to their liquidity management in the years leading up to the crisis. Following this experience, the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision proposed tougher liquidity requirements as part of its broader package of reforms known as the Basel III regulations. Now, these changes have made the banking system more resilient to periods of financial stress. One of the key planks of these requirements, the requirement to increase liquidity of the banks, was the introduction of a liquidity coverage ratio, or an LCR. And the LCR requires banks to have enough high-quality liquid assets to cover their estimated net cash outflows during a scenario that entails a 30-day period of stress for that bank. And so the idea is that a bank experiencing stress will therefore have enough liquid assets that they can use to meet their short-term liquidity needs. And in that way, the banks hold a sufficient amount of HQLA as self-insurance against liquidity risk. And just like all insurance products, it comes with a cost. In this case, the cost to each bank is incurred because the HQLA, the high-quality liquid assets, earn a lower yield than the alternative less liquid assets that the bank could otherwise hold, such as mortgages or business loans. So for HQLA securities to be of sufficient quality and liquidity, they should be both low risk and actively traded in markets. In Australia's case, Australian government securities and securities issued by the states and territories, borrowing authorities, the SEMIs, these two meet this test. In contrast, there's relatively little trading in other Australian dollar securities, such as those issued by foreign agencies, the banks, foreign banks and securitisation trusts. However, there's less government debt in Australia, as you can see here, relative to the size of the banking system or the economy more generally, than is the case for many other countries. And so that means that there's fewer HQLA in Australia. Indeed, back in 2015, if there'd been no other way for the Australian banks to meet their liquidity coverage ratios, collectively, they would have had to have held around two-thirds of the stock of AGS and SEMIs. And if the banks had held such a high share of those government securities, well, then the liquidity of those markets would have been substantially impaired, and thereby defeating the purpose of them being counted as HQLA in the first place. So in recognition of this issue, the Basel liquidity standards allow jurisdictions with limited HQLA, such as Australia, to use alternative approaches. And one of those approaches is for the central bank to offer a facility to provide banks with a guaranteed source of liquidity. And so with that, the CLF was born. This entails the central bank committing to stand ready to provide a bank with liquidity against high-quality collateral that would otherwise be illiquid in the market. And this commitment can be counted by banks towards meeting their LCR. And in return for this facility, banks are charged a fee on the entire committed amount, whether or not they actually draw down on those funds. This facility. So this fee again is akin to insurance, an insurance premium that banks would implicitly pay if instead of the CLF they had to hold that additional HQLA. And then starting from 2015, the Reserve Banks provided the CLF as part of its Australia's implementation of the Basel III liquidity reforms. Let me just review then the first 5 years of that briefly. So under the CLF, the RBA commits to provide liquidity under repo against securities eligible in its operations. So to access the CLF, a bank must meet several conditions. First, it must have paid its CLF fee. Second, the bank's CEO has to have attested that the bank has positive net worth. And we, the bank, the Reserve Bank, has to have judged that this is indeed the case. In the 5 years since the CLF was introduced, 15 banks have applied to APRA for access to the CLF. None of those banks have needed to draw on the facility in response to a period of financial stress. Each year, it's APRA that determines the total size of the CLF. It's the difference between the banking system's liquidity needs and the amount of AGS and semis that the RBA assesses that banks can hold without impairing the functioning of that market. The size of the CLF was set at $274 billion in 2015. And as an input to this, the RBA assessed that the banks could reasonably hold 25% of the stock of AGS and semis, and that was a sizeable step up from their holdings earlier in the decade. However, since then, the stock of AGS and semis has actually increased by almost a third. And in comparison, the LCR requirements of the banks have been little changed. So the banks can hold more HQLA securities compared to their liquidity needs. And as a result, the size of the CLF has declined to just below $250 billion. So it went from 274 to 250. The increase in AGS and semis also meant that the shortage of HQLA securities is not as large as it once was, although there still is a shortage. So to assess the amount of HQLA securities that the banks can reasonably hold, the RBA takes into account the behaviour of other holders of these securities, along with conditions in bond and repo markets. In 2015, a large share, as you can see here, of Australian government debt was held by what can be described as buy and hold investors. That is, these investors were not particularly sensitive to the prices of these securities, and typically they didn't contribute to liquidity in the market. Many of these investors were non-residents, which were holding nearly 60% of the total stock of HQLA securities earlier in the decade. However, over recent years, more HQLA securities have become available for use as collateral. In particular, the Australian repo market's grown substantially, driven by more HQLA securities being sold under repo. Of note, non-residents have been lending more of their holdings of AGS and semis back into the domestic market, which is what you can see here. Also, our analysis of transactions in bond and repo markets demonstrates that most HQLA securities were being actively traded. Turnover ratios for individual AGS bond lines were well above zero and much higher than for other Australian dollar securities. And although semis were traded less frequently than AGS, only a small share of this of the bond lines of semis had very low turnover ratios. So given this, it appears unlikely that a moderate increase in banks' holdings of AGS and semis would present a problem for liquidity in these markets. Now, another issue we considered in 2015 was the so-called scarcity premium that was present for AGS. Australia's relatively strong economic performance and AAA credit rating may have been very appealing, appeared to have been very appealing for investors globally. And the scarcity premium was prominent in the years leading up to 2015. When the yield on AGS was well below the expected cash rate over the period to maturity, as you can see here. Since then, however, the scarcity premium has gradually dissipated. This has occurred alongside an increase in the stock of AGS. Remember, I said that that has increased noticeably. It's also consistent with these securities being less tightly held. So the combination of these changes suggests that banks can now hold a higher share of AGS on issue without, again, without impairing the functioning of the market. And that brings me to the first of the two changes that we've made to the setting of the CLF, We've assessed the banks can increase their holdings of HQLA securities from 25 to 30% of the outstanding stock. And that's going to result in the CLF being smaller than it otherwise would have been. To minimise the effect of this change on the market, though, the increase is going to occur gradually at a pace of 1 percentage point each year, beginning with an increase to 26% in 2020. So now I want to turn to the second change we're implementing, which relates to the setting of the CLF fee. The CLF fee, in theory at least, should be set at a level where banks face a similar financial incentive to meet their LCR either by holding the CLF or by holding the HQLA. However, determining this level of the fee is certainly easier to do in theory than in practice. The starting point for determining the fee is to make use of the spread between the yields on HQLA securities and the yields on the collateral that the banks hold for CLF. This collateral is eligible for all of the RBA's market operations. It's mainly the bank's self-securitised residential mortgage-backed securities. So we've estimated this spread was around 90 basis points earlier this year, but the higher yield on those CLF collateral reflect compensation for a variety of risks, and in particular a sizable share of that spread, that 90 basis points, owes to the higher credit risk on these securities. However, the CLF should only reflect the liquidity component of that spread, and it's very difficult to sort of pull that out and identify it separately. When the Reserve Bank set the CLF fee earlier this decade, it looked at repo rates on some CLF-eligible securities to gauge how much that one-month liquidity premium might be worth, and the answer was not very much in normal times. Based on data from the RBA's open market operations, it was estimated to be around 10 basis points. However, given the whole point of the liquidity reforms was to recognise that the market had underpriced liquidity in the past, it was judged to have been appropriate to set the fee at 15 basis points. So that's where we were. But we've now had several years of experience with the CLF, and we can look back and in particular see how it is that the banks have responded to the existing framework. And since it was introduced, the banks in total have consistently overestimated their net cash outflow projections, which is what they use in their CLF applications for the following year. So these projections are then used by APRA to determine the size of the CLF, and as a result, the banks have been granted a larger CLF than would have been the case had the net cash outflow projections been more accurate, ex ante at least. In recent years, the banks have also been holding fewer HQLA securities than the RBA judged they could reasonably hold. So taken together, these observations suggest the CLF fee should be set at a higher rate in the future. The banks at the margin were preferencing CLF over HQLA, so we hadn't quite got the pricing right. That's the idea. So a higher CLF fee are going to help make the banks indifferent between holding more HQLA securities and asking for a larger CLF. But if we take that too far, if we set the fee too high, then that could trigger a disruptive shift away from using the CLF facility and create distortions in markets that use HQLA. So accordingly, we've concluded the fee should be increased moderately and that that should occur in two steps. The fee is going to rise, therefore, from 15 currently to 17 basis points in January of next year, and then to 20 basis points the following January, in January 2021. So when taken together, these two changes to the setting for the CLF will result in a small increase in the cost of the CLF for banks. To show this, we can fully apply the new settings to the current CLF amounts, assuming that everything else is held constant. So if the banks were holding the higher level of AGS and semis that the RBA assessed would be reasonable, this would reduce the size of the CLF from just below $250 billion to around $200 billion. So they've got less to pay for, but it's at a slightly higher price, because if we apply the 5 basis points total increase in the CLF fee, then collectively the banks would pay around $30 million more than they currently do for the liquidity commitment they receive from the banks. So in conclusion, the CLF is an important part of Australia's implementation of the Basel III liquidity reforms. The facility's been working well but after 5 years, it's time to make some modest and gradual adjustments to the settings in a way that reduces the need of the banks to make use of the CLF, while also increasing their cost of doing so just a little. In combination, these two changes are going to help to ensure the banks continue to have strong incentives to manage their liquidity risks appropriately. So let me finish there and hand the floor over to Michael. Thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Michael Heath. I'm the economics reporter for Bloomberg in Sydney and Chris's annual interlocutor, it seems. So I was just going to start off in terms of questions with a couple on the CLF, and then we'll probably switch across to more macro. But if you do have any CLF questions, feel free to ask them, and then I'll open to the floor as well. So I guess we'll open, Chris. I'm not big on acronyms, so I'll sort of spell it out.
Please do.
With authorised deposit-taking institutions, do they primarily hold high-quality liquidity assets to meet their liquidity requirements, or do they use a mix of the high-quality assets and the committed liquidity facility?
So it's a mix. Got it here somewhere. The bulletin article that I'll commend you to has a lot more detail than in my speech, and it's got a lovely table in there which answers exactly this question. Oh, okay. It's a mix. The CLF accounts for a little over half of their liquidity needs, but that need has decreased a little bit over the past 5 years because, as I suggested, the HQLA stock has increased somewhat, and yet their needs have been little changed for liquidity. So they've used a little bit more HQLA and a little bit less of the CLF over time. That's why we saw a reduction from 275 billion or close to about 250 in the CLF.
Sure. And obviously the government's projecting a surplus, which sort of raises again this issue of a fall in bonds and obviously high quality liquid assets. I mean, does this create issues in terms of authorised deposit-taking institutions meeting their liquidity requirement if this comes to pass?
Well, of course, I think it's worth remembering in earlier times when, in circumstances when net public debt was very, very low, and this was a concern. It was recognised by the markets, by the regulators and by the government of the day, the value in maintaining a pretty healthy bond market. And so it was also recognised you can have low net debt but still issue a healthy amount of bonds for use exactly for these sorts of purposes and other purposes to which they're put. So I think that's worth remembering. Even so, I think we're some way away from that point. But if we were to get there, well, the CLF operates already somewhat flexibly. So if we were to see a decline in the stock of AGS and semis, not just the Fed's bonds, the government bonds, but the local state and authorities. If we were to see that, then because what we say is the banks will be, in time, able to hold up to 30%, it's not an absolute amount, it's a share. Mm-hmm. So they'll just hold a smaller absolute amount, if that market does contract.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. The CLF obviously is for authorised deposit-taking institutions, which are regulated by APRA. I mean, what about shadow banks? Where do they go in the event of a liquidity squeeze?
Right. Well, of course, almost by definition, they're shadow banks, so they're not taking deposits. So one hopes their liquidity needs a little bit more modest. But even so, they may have important liquidity needs, and they need to attend to those. They can do that by just holding HQLA themselves, right? And then use that in various markets to obtain liquidity at short notice, just as the banks can. They could also go to a bank and get a committed line of credit. They'll have to pay for that, but that's the point. They have to pay for their liquidity needs and insurance just like anyone else. I think the other point to recognise, though, is that they can do all of those things without disrupting those markets or being a big influence because they're still relatively small in the scheme of things.
Sure, okay. Let's go to good stuff. So the Governor's repeatedly said, when he's referred to easing monetary policy, that a key transmission channel now when there's this discussion on how much traction you get with rate cuts now is through the exchange rate. Now, the Aussie appears to have found a base on both the TWA and against the US dollar, and particularly given other major central banks are turning dovish, how much of an issue is this turning into for the RBA?
Well, it's an issue we and every central bank play close attention to because the exchange rate is an important part of the transmission mechanism. I think it's been broadly working as you would expect, that is, other things equal, the reductions in the Aussie cash rate that you've seen of late will have tended to put downward pressure on the Aussie dollar. But other things are never equal. And the other things that are not equal, well, there's a couple of them. One, commodity prices are continuing to sort of hold up in a way that hadn't been fully appreciated by forecasters, us included. And that's a welcome and positive thing for the economy, very much so. And the other thing is other central banks, as you suggested, have turned more dovish. But I think the thing to remember is that that doesn't mean the reductions in the cash rate here have not had their effect on the exchange rate in the normal way. It's just that there are other forces possibly working the other direction. But you could say, well, absent those reductions in the cash rate here, the Aussie dollar might have been higher than otherwise.
Right, OK. But, I mean, is there any degree of frustration that you're still seeing it above 70 cents after a couple of cuts? Or not much you can do about it?
I wouldn't focus particularly on any given level. And I wouldn't describe it as frustration because I think the thing to remember is when the major central banks around the world ease monetary policy, that's an easing of global financial conditions. And one of the things it's intended to do is to support stronger inflation, to soak up the spare capacity that there is in the global economy. And that's kind of a positive thing for Australia. It has less of an effect through our exchange rate than you otherwise might like, but we're not in the business of trying to dial up a particular exchange rate.
Okay. To the floor, has anyone got any questions? I'd like to hand up the back there.
Matt Zonmeyer from Kangaroo News. If the banks end up holding the 30% stock of AGS, has there been any work done on what the effect on the liquidity of those instruments might be if they reach that upper threshold?
Well, I think that's a very hard thing to do with any science. I think what we have done, though, is just looked at that market and realised it has become increasingly liquid over time, as I suggested, partly because non-residents are acting a bit less like the buy-and-hold investors that they were, and they're willing to sort of provide these assets back into the market for various purposes. So, I mean, our assessment is you might be concerned to see a rapid increase in the bank's holdings of HQLA, of AGS, from and semis from 25% to 30% in one short go. And that's why we've staged it gradually, just 1% a year. But I think that market's shown itself to be quite liquid and increasingly so, and that's why we're confident that we can require the banks to hold a bit more as part of their liquidity needs.
Anyone else?
Jason Miller from ANZ. What about the impact of the RBA holding bonds on repo to that calculation of the 30%? Does that play a factor in your assessment of the availability of the amount the bank should hold?
Not so much. So I think what you're suggesting is the banks themselves, through our open market operations, are providing this collateral in the form of repo so they can obtain cash over a short period of time.
Yeah, you're funding those bonds.
I mean, I don't think that's sizable enough to sort of, I mean, that's part of the market, an important part, but that sort of action helps to, in fact, convince people that these, amongst other things, not that they need convincing, but this part of the act of them being liquid assets, right? We take them, everyone else takes them under repo. So you know if you're holding these assets, you can provide them to many people, including the banks, who will happily take them, and then they can use them exactly for the purpose you're suggesting. So I think that, if anything, is contributing to the liquidity in the market rather than somehow withdrawing liquidity from the market.
Anybody else at this stage? The 11s.
Bill Evans from Westpac. Chris, you've talked about the... we've had two rate cuts. We've had two rate cuts, and there's a lot of talk about looking at other parts of the world with regard to the use of quantitative easing. Is there any sort of guideline that the bank would use in terms of deciding when to switch from rate cuts to quantitative easing if it was seen that the economy needed more stimulus?
I think the first thing I'd say about quantitative easing, or the broader sort of term of unconventional monetary policies, is that I still think it's a very low likelihood event. We're a long way away from something like that. Having said that, of course, it's prudent for us as good central bankers to sort of be thinking about these things, and what we've been doing, of course, is looking at what others have done and their experience and what we can learn from that. I think what you can learn from that is that perhaps one of the most important lessons is you need to tailor these policies to your own circumstances, to your own economic circumstances. In most cases, these were policies that were started in the depths of the financial crisis when the credit system was quite impaired. That's not the sort of thing I think people have at the back of their minds here. The other thing you have to do is tailor it to your unique circumstances, your financial system. What's the structure like? How much of a banked market do you have? So those are the things we're sort of looking at and thinking, but again, I'd come back to emphasise we see this as a pretty unlikely event.
Chris, obviously the Fed is expected to cut later this month. I mean, it was put to the governor, I think, after the first cut, you know, what it might, and things were a little bit less probable then, what it might mean for Australia if the Fed does choose to ease, particularly with the currency. And I think he mentioned it would make things more complex or more complicated, something along those lines. I mean, how much pressure would it put on you if they do cut it, you know, more than once, cut a couple of times? Does that really put the onus back on you to then act as well again?
Well, the markets are fairly convinced that the Fed is going to reduce rates. There's a question, of course, still how much they're going to do, and is part of this expectation accounting for some of the downside risks. So they're not central. They're not the central projection. Now, having said that, I mean, the markets, including the FX markets, should already encapsulate that information in the exchange rate. Fine. That doesn't mean that the exchange rate won't react if and when the Fed does cut rates, particularly if it has implications for people's expectations even further down the track as to how much they might do, assuming they get started with the first one soon. I'd come back to, I mean, every central bank that faces inflation that's low, they'd like to see the unemployment rate decline. To generate some more wage growth, to generate some more inflation. That's a situation we're in. Every central bank in that situation would like it if they could be delivered with a lower exchange rate, because that's a way of delivering that extra demand they need to try and generate the extra strength in the economy that they're looking for. But we can't all dial it up, their exchange rates. We can't all have a lower exchange rate, and we're not in the process of trying to do that. The flexible exchange rate served us well. So is it a complication? Maybe at the margins. But again, I come back to what I said earlier. This is an easing in global financial conditions if it comes to pass. That's a strengthening in the global economy, other things equal.
Mm-hmm. So coming out of that, the markets are sort of pricing in a pretty good chance that you guys will go again by the end of the year, as is Bloomberg's poll. I mean, is that a reasonable take on where things stand?
The good interest rate question, even more fun than the exchange rate question. look, what I'll do is just emphasise that I'll replay what we've said very clearly after the board. The governor said the board will continue to monitor developments in the labour market, adjust monetary policy if needed. I'd highlight the if needed part to support sustainable growth in the economy and the achievement of the inflation target. I'd emphasise that, right? We're still trying to achieve the inflation target. We're not trying to achieve an unemployment rate target. Markets, I think, before this came out, were pricing in the possibility of the cut that came to pass and then a second cut of 25 basis points before the end of the year. That's where they were before this. That's where they were after this. Yeah. So I think that they've interpreted this in that way. And
I'll come to Andrew in 1 second, but I guess so. The point being, as Bill sort of pointed out yesterday, that your forecasts on inflation and that sort of thing in next month's monetary policy statement become a bit more significant, perhaps in that sense. Then,
To a degree, but we're always every month, even though we might not be publishing full detailed forecast every month, we're thinking about how the inflow of data is affecting the outlook for inflation, for the labour market, for the economy more broadly. So I wouldn't get overly fixated on those months where we happen to sort of publish detailed forecasts in that regard.
Okay, Andrew.
Thank you. Chris, Andrew Tysest from Nomura. Let me take half a step back and ask you a slightly different sort of monetary policy question. We're clearly in an environment where global growth has slowed a little bit, global risks are more elevated, uncertainty around trade. And we're seeing central banks in the region and all the major ones, as we're talking about, either cutting rates or signalling that they might. This is pushing yields on HQLA-type assets to very low levels and encouraging a search for yield, which is almost desperate. Maybe desperate's too strong a word, but my interactions with investors, I definitely get that sense. So we're in an environment with more elevated risk, but because of central bank actions, very, very tight credit and risk spreads. Is that an inevitable consequence of monetary policy as it's currently being practiced? Is that a material negative side effect? Is that something that concerns you?
I think you could turn the argument around the other way. If banks, central banks had signalled the need for a bit more monetary stimulus by, you know, in our case, dropping policy rates, and that's what's, you know, on the cards for many banks around the world, and long-term bond markets didn't respond by lowering yields, then that would be of some concern. I think this is how monetary policy operates. We've said a little bit in over various times as to why those long-term yields are very low. They're very low because people just don't see any upside risks for inflation. But central banks, part of their intent here is to try and help increase inflation and can convince people that they can achieve their targets. So one way they do that is through lowering the yield curve. And I think, you know, that's how monetary policy works. So I think, turn it around, you'd be very worried, I think, in a world where they were doing and saying what they have said and bond yields went the other way or were unresponsive. Then you'd say they have there's no potency in monetary policy, whereas I think there is.
Are there other questions around? Over here, please.
And there's one down there.
Will McInnes, the Fin Review. If you did decide to commit to QE, what role would the CLF play within that?
Well, I'll start again by emphasising I still think that's a very unlikely event. But I don't see that it would play a substantial role. I'm not sure. You know, if by QE people talk about the purchase of by central banks of assets, I'm not sure that would necessarily have any implications for the direct implications for the CLF. I think it would continue to operate as normal.
Hi, Sophia from Goldman Sachs. Just a question on the labour market. Given the high participation rates that we've been seeing, could you give some colour on how the RBA is thinking about the trade-off between, on the one hand, a higher participation rate, which is, you know, a sign of labour market strength, versus, on the other hand, a low unemployment rate or an unemployment rate that's been kept high as a result of kind of a pure accounting identity? You know, to what extent is the RBA just going to bluntly target a low unemployment rate if we keep seeing the part rate go higher?
Well, I don't think we're going to, as I tried to emphasise before, not targeting an unemployment rate, but we do want to see it lower. And the goal there is to see spare capacity in the economy more generally, but also in the labour market, to be reduced, so wage pressures, price pressures can lift, and we can get back to inflation that's consistent with our medium-term inflation target. I think you're right, though, in characterising sort of the rise in participation rate as an element of strength of the labour market. It's being helped along by pretty strong employment growth. Employment growth's really been holding up. And that's fine and that's well and good, but when we look at something like wage growth, say the WPI, the last couple of readings, which were a bit lower on a quarterly basis than the two prior to that, that says despite that strength in employment, rising participation, those sort of good elements of what's happening in the labour market, there is a lot more flexibility, a lot more spare capacity in the labour market than you otherwise might have thought if you just look back at history and said, well, where did we get wage pressures? At what levels of unemployment did we get wage pressures before? You would have thought maybe we would have started to see more sooner than we have currently. So a higher participation, strong employment growth, that's an element of strength. That's a good thing. But there's a lot of spare capacity, which is not a bad thing, but we want to reduce that spare capacity by getting unemployment rate down, eating into that so people feel more confident with higher wage growth and more price growth as well at the same time. Because there's spare capacity in the labour market, there's spare capacity in the markets for goods and services as well.
Questions? Okay, good. The neutral rate, I just wanted to raise this. This obviously caused a bit of interest. I think it was 2017 when you released an estimate in the minutes. You had you'd had a special research paper, I think, that you'd looked at the board meeting, and you were estimating the neutral rate at about 3.5%, which I think people thought was quite high. My question, I guess, is that still the bank's general view? And I ask in the context of Fed Chief Jay Powell saying this month that the Fed's was probably lower than it used to be and that as a result their policy had been a bit too restrictive, I think were his words, or words to that effect as well. Mm. I mean, is it something you're constantly monitoring, or is there what's the take there now?
Constantly would be, I think, a slight overstatement, but something we monitor regular, yes. So as you said, so we had some research, and it was published in a bulletin article as well, which showed in 2017 that the nominal neutral interest rate was around 3.5. So that that was a real rate of around 1% in its. But I'd emphasise. The thing about that publication is it also showed there's a wide range of uncertainty. And so we're sort of only reasonably confident that it was centred around 1, but plus or minus 0.75%. So there's a lot of uncertainty there. And it had also come down over time, and that was not unique to us. That's a global phenomenon, and there's lots of reasons for that, including a reduction in trend growth productivity, and there's all sorts of other reasons, demographic included. Has it fallen further? Maybe, but again, there's such a range of uncertainty around that, and it's very hard to pin down some of these things that precisely. I wouldn't overestimate that. In terms of what it means for us, I think it means with the nominal neutral rate at 3.5, the cash rate at 1, we're still clearly in stimulatory territory.
Mm, sure. This is obviously not an issue that's facing you now when people are talking about QE or very low rates, but we've just had a tightening cycle in the US, which, you know, sort of a rare beast. Mm. Have you taken any lessons from that? I mean, it seems extraordinary that their economy looked very strong on so many elements, and yet they didn't really manage to get rates up that high before they're ready to cut again. I mean, are there any takeaways for you from that
well,
cycle?
I think it comes back to the point you were just raising. The neutral rate is lower. And that's a global phenomenon. So in order for monetary policy to take effect in a tightening cycle, you might not need to see rates go up to where they were in the past. And that's really a story about the real rates, the real neutral rate being lower. Because I still think it's, and the Fed has showed, it's possible to achieve your inflation targets. That many other advanced economies are doing that currently. Mm. The Canadians are just one example. It's not for want of lack of inflation, but central banks are concerned that inflation expectations might ratchet down if inflation stays a bit too low and lower than their targets for too long. I think that lower real neutral rate is a global phenomenon. It's going to be with us for some time.
Hmm. Okay. Last call. If anyone has any questions, please. Yes.
Thanks. It's Matt from Sumitomo Mitsui Bank. You mentioned it in your speech about the transmission effect. In the current environment, would that have extended from, I guess, the theoretical, I think I remember it was 9 months, or from rate cuts and taking effect and seeing the effects of rate cuts like you've just done? Is that something that you think about, and has it extended, or given the current environment?
I think it's reasonable that it's always plausible that it's changing at the margins, but I don't think we know exactly the speed of all of the different mechanisms that well. I don't see there's any reason why it would have shortened or lengthened particularly. It might be changing in slightly different ways, but I don't see the time element would have changed, obviously, one way or the other.
Last call. Anybody else? Okay, if we could put our hands together for Chris for another... Bravo performance.